Welcome back to another episode of The Money Seat. Thanks for joining us again, and I hope you're doing well. My guest today with me is Andrew. And Andrew, I'd love if you tell the audience a little bit about yourself so we can know you a little bit better.
Hey, you guys. Again, my name is Andrew. Grew up in the Chicagoland area. Currently working as a GM at a small fast casual restaurant. Degree in education and history. So I'm making really good use of all
of my history in college. It's a nice use of the degree, yeah.
Yeah, great investment. I've got a $150,000 receipt, essentially. That's all it is.
Most people could feel your pain, I think, listening to this.
I know, right? Yeah, no kidding. We were just talking about that last week, too, so.
Yeah. Perfect.
Short and simple. So what are we doing today, Russ?
Yeah, I actually have a question. What kind of a restaurant do you work for?
So do you want the name? Should we?
Whatever. Yeah, if you want to do some free promotion for your restaurant, throw it in there. Yeah.
It's called 10Q Chicken. It's just a really fast casual Korean style wings, chicken sandwiches, and nice. Rice bowls. And the long-term goal is, it's brought on. I'm trying to get some equity out of it. Again, mm-hmm. Something you and I talked about last year and a half ago.
Yeah.
It's grown really fast. We actually managed to grow during the quarantine, which is absolutely surreal. I didn't expect that.
Awesome. That's a big deal.
Yeah, we have big plans, and I'm hoping, we grow into something substantial. That's what I'm hitching my horse to for the next few years.
Yeah. Well, I know you're busy. Thanks for taking time out of your day to do this. How many hours a week do you work there?
Right now, I'm hovering around 50 to 60.
Okay.
And that's
not
terrible. Yeah. I mean, I've got a staff now that I think I could trust with, my life.
Okay.
And I'm willing to step away from it without too much anxiety.
Okay.
When the quarantine hit, it was, I went from a staff of, 15 down to just me, the other GM, manager, and the head cook, and we were working probably around 90 to 120 hours just to keep the cost down, and that was really fun.
Well, that's the sweat equity, hopefully.
That's the sweat equity.
Yeah,
you put that vernacular in my head, and I went to them because you remember when I first started working. But for the first time, I can take two, maybe even 3 days off in a week.
Oh, nice.
We're like a stable. But when I'm there, it's 12 to 13 hours.
Okay. So. Yeah, I know. My brother, who's got the restaurant, is a similar thing.
Yeah,
it's a tough segue
too far off.
No.
I'm sure he knows.
He does. So. It's a tough industry. It's hard to take time off. Restaurants, people are eating 24/7, whether the world stops, whether there's a holiday. So it's a tough industry to be in terms of hours worked and you physically having to be there. I know that. Before we start, could you give the audience a quick idea? How old are you?
32, just passed.
32. Married, single, kids, anything like that? Nope.
No, nothing. And I think right now that stuff, if I'm pursuing this business.
Uh-huh.
Entrepreneurial, whatever, dream. Definitely being single and not having kids is helpful.
Yeah.
I'll put it that way. It's helpful.
I can imagine. I can imagine.
Yeah. I mean, it allows me to just focus on myself and the business without really worrying about, I guess, extending myself out too far.
Yeah. So. You say that. I say distractions. Tomato, tomato.
Yeah. You said
that. Everyone was thinking it. I might as well say it. Perfect. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I would say, let's get to it. Time to put me on the money seat. And you got some questions prepared that you have not sent me beforehand.
Yeah.
And I hope they're interesting and exciting. And without further ado, let's get started. What do you got for me?
Money laundering. No, we're not. We're gonna go. Actually, on the subject of small business, and I would love it if you could get Danielson put on this too. Mm-hmm. Labor percentage, labor costs. Like, that is probably the biggest philosophical difference the partners and I are butting heads on.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in an ideal world, I want to pay all these guys $20 an hour, right? And I want to make sure they feel respected, they're stable, right? And they feel like they're being taken care of, because the staff that I have right now is great because there's no turnaround.
Yes.
I don't have young kids. I don't have inexperienced people. The staff right now, I want to look at them like professionals.
Right.
But for the partners, it's simply, it's pure percent. You know, I'm the one on the front line. I'm the intermediary between what they want and what the partners want, what the staff wants and what the partners want. I mean, what's a reasonable percent for labor? Because everybody says it has to be under 18%.
And by labor, I'm assuming do you just mean salary and payroll? Or are you talking about benefits,
right now,
expenses?
I think most people do include salary into labor, right? Is that the norm?
Yeah, salary, benefits, if you have to provide health insurance or 401ks,
right,
or all,
I mean,
of those costs.
In a fast casual restaurant, like,
yeah,
there's no benefits.
Yeah. Right.
So how would you balance that? Especially, you know, because it's a low-skilled job, supposedly.
It's really difficult, and it's really difficult in America because of minimum wage.
Right.
You know, the minimum wage, and this is a whole topic for another time, but while it has a lot of benefits, it actually has a lot of consequences to business owners, exactly how your situation is, where it is unskilled labor, where for the most part, if someone leaves, you could replace them pretty easily, besides maybe a few weeks of training and a few hiccups.
Right.
It's not like this person has this exceptional skill unless you're in fine dining, right? So in your situation, it's very hard because you don't have a choice. You have to pay someone X amount.
Right.
And usually that is, in America, because of minimum wage, it's not cheap. And it creates a little bit of an issue, because then what happens is you have to charge more for your food to make up the difference.
Well, I mean, there seems to be a real change in the zeitgeist, especially our generation and the incoming generation.
Right.
And just because you increase a dollar wage across the board doesn't necessarily mean your sandwich is going to go up by 40%.
Right.
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 So there still is like a balance. Right? I know the partners, they want huge returns because we're looking for capital investors, so we become this big franchise. Now, we need to show them that this is a really profitable business.
Yes. Yes, you do.
So, you know, we have to simplify the menu. We have to streamline the workflow from prep to line cook, right? So this is something that is very conscientious and something I'm thinking about constantly myself. But with that said, I feel like a lot of the success that I've been able to squeeze from this business is because I've found a staff, given them the fringe benefits without the actual cash. Right.
Right.
So it's man, I mean, I know that if this were you can probably disagree with, if this were my business, I'd be giving beyond the 15%. Or $15 an hour.
You'd be doing more than minimum wage. I would say that there's nothing wrong with that, but you have to make sure you know the numbers behind that. So, so you need to crunch, okay, what are your costs going to go up in terms of total labor? And I assume for most of the time, people can break this down. And if you haven't done this yet, it's something you need to do, where you could break out the actual cost of each sandwich or keeping your restaurant open for each hour, right? And if you have everything calculated down to that minuscule detail, then you should be able to know exactly how much it costs you to make each sandwich item or each food item or fried chicken item, based on if we're paying you $17.50 an hour instead of $15, what does that extra $2.50 do to my cost of goods sold and everything? And then honestly, you could probably adjust prices, you know, 10 cents, a quarter cents accordingly. So at least you're making the informed decisions. I would say that it's very to do what you want to do, there's nothing wrong with that, but you have to know the math and the right. numbers behind it. So I would caution you or anyone else to do it without knowing how it's gonna the ripple effect would be. Because while you do want to reward your people, who knows, it could end up costing you more than you think, and all of a sudden your margins could shrink to a point where it's not as attractive right. to investors.
Yeah, and that actually, you know, we when we first opened, we did a real rough cost uh-huh. analysis, I guess you can say.
Yeah.
We haven't done it since, and it's been a 2.5
then
years.
You're going to have to do that before you even make those decisions, because otherwise you're just hoping and guessing, and that's never...
Exactly.
This is why people fail in business. It's not because they have a bad idea. It's not because your food isn't bad. A lot of times it's because sometimes the numbers, they didn't quite understand the numbers, and they didn't quite
right.
change their business or operate them. So I would say you want to look at those numbers much more in depth first, and then you'll be uh-huh. able to make those decisions with doing that. And I think you'll be hopefully surprised and feel more comfortable about your business once you do that.
Yeah, and then unfortunately the partners haven't given me full access
yeah.
to company costs. And you know, and I'm gonna be very blunt on this. I know why. They can't have right.
Yeah, well, it's a very personal thing, and I get it. It's not something you yeah. give to everyone. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, listen, I love these guys, and you know, when the reviews come in from direct personal customer interactions, it's not just the food; it's that environment.
Yes,
the customer service.
Absolutely.
Stuff. I mean, it's so important to be able to deliver on that point. And you know, I mean, you know, a Friday night, I'll show up with a 24-pack and just be like, you guys did great. Go get hammered. Like,
and that might be the way to handle it for now on. Now, is there's always a way for – so once again, the money thing isn't necessarily that they deserve – everyone deserves to be paid fairly for the work right. they put in, but that's not the world we live in. A lot of the idea right. is, well, how do you make them feel like they're appreciated for what they do? And that's right. why most of the time it's to give them a raise. So you just have right. to be creative, knowing you might not have that discretion right now, but what are other ways to be creative right. to show the appreciation? Like what you said, the bringing in some beers and taking them out after a hard day's work is a great thing to just mm-hmm. feel appreciated. A lot of people would rather feel appreciated and have some other compensation than money. Not everyone wants the raise, which right. is interesting.
And I mean, fringe benefits. I mean, that's really the least I can do.
Right. And, yep. That's but
yeah. I mean, I'll put a few. Hey, Will, Dave, I'm putting a bunch on the company card. All right, if you're listening to this. But you know. Can I go back to that? So
yeah.
How does the minimum wage in the U.S., because outside of the U.S., I mean, for instance, I know in Korea, like, service industry wages are stupid low comparative
mm-hmm.
to the U.S. But I also know, in contrast, like, places in France, if you're, like, a server at a proper sit-down restaurant, you're getting paid
right.
a livable salary.
Mm-hmm.
So how does... our minimum wage compare, how does it affect us differently compared to other countries?
All right.
Do you know that at all?
Yeah, I can speak a little bit on that. I'm going to count that as, is that part of your, is that all part of question one, or is that a separate question?
I mean, you know what? let me go back to my list. I've got sub-questions.
You only get five.
Let's make it two. Okay.
So okay.
We'll make that two.
Okay. That's perfectly fine. Yeah. So that's a great question. I mean, it's one of the reasons why you don't see things still manufactured and created and done in the U.S.
Right.
And a lot of it is dollars and cents. If you could go to Korea right. or China or the Philippines or somewhere else and they could make the same product, right, and you're paying them 10 cents an hour as opposed to minimum wage here.
Right. Exactly.
It, you know, it sucks and heartless as it is. I get it, right? I mean, that's a tremendous amount of money to save. Each country has their own economy and their own little infrastructure where they encourage things like that. So Italy has a similar thing as you were saying in France, where if you're someone working at a waiter or maybe as unskilled labor in a grocery store or something, you're going to make a livable wage. But there's a downside to that is a lot of the top people, maybe top businessmen, top doctors or something, they're not making what they do in more capitalistic societies like we are. So they end up leaving. So you end up getting, like, I remember we were in Italy and they were saying that all the doctors would leave Italy and go to other countries because a doctor wouldn't make much more than the guy at the toll station taking the toll. So, and that's crazy. So it really affects some things and helps others. So for instance, manufacturing and making things doesn't make our economy and our country very good for that because of minimum wage. But at the same time, if you have paying people top dollar to do things, you're going to attract the best talent for it. So it's kind of very interesting and not a very easy situation because people need to make a livable wage in order to work. And minimum wage, even though it's very high in this country, is not livable. You can't have a 40-hour a week minimum wage job and live by yourself, you know, in most areas. You're from Chicago, I'm from Seattle. It's very difficult to do that.
Cost of living.
And you would never be able to save enough to retire. You'd never be able to save enough for vacations and really have any expendable income, which is a huge problem. And so what happens if you keep raising minimum wage up? Well, then your breakfast, then your fried chicken is going to cost $20, right? Because the costs end up get passing on to us, which then makes our cost of living cost more, which makes our minimum wage mean less. If everything costs more and you raise minimum wage, you're also raising the cost of things. So it's a little complicated. A lot of this is economics and there's a lot of studies that go on it. And it's very hard in America with such a large country, but smaller countries can do this when there's less people in the workforce. Yeah, exactly. So it's a really tricky question. Yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
No. And I get that because, you know, I feel like I'm staring at Mount Everest from space. You know, it's just one endless series of small problems we have to fix to create anything
worthwhile. The idea is, and what's happened in the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years before we were even alive, is that a lot of the wealth gets trapped up on top in those top lawyers, top CEOs, top doctors, the top executives and top people of society. And enough of it doesn't trickle down, but they've started doing some experiments with some companies I've noticed where instead of the president or CEO makes, you know, 100 or 1,000 times more than the bottom paid people, they'll have a minimum salary. So like, you know, a $75,000 a year or a $100,000 a year salary. And then the CEO or president doesn't make, you know, $20 million a year. They make five. And reallocating some of that income really helps create the middle class and what you're doing for a lot of people. Because when and that works too in the restaurant industry. If no one's making money, then that's fair, right? You know, it's not like you're making a bunch. It's not like the owners of your company are. But if all of a sudden you guys started seeing a whole bunch of money and then you kept it all, then that would create an issue.
It's like an ice cap.
Accumulating. Yeah, and it doesn't quite trickle down. In theory, it should, and it sounds good. And then in reality, people get greedy. People, it doesn't work out, and there's the solution for that is not have so many greedy people or you know, regulating it. And then how do you regulate? And then that becomes its whole thing. So it's very that's the problem.
I'm overwhelmed.
And there's no easy solution to that. I don't have a lot of answers to that. A lot of that bleeds into politics and economics, and it bleeds off different strengths and categories. So, you know, all you could do is acknowledge it and know that if you're running the show, you're going to try to make sure that money trickles down to everyone so they can feel right. free. And I would say that's the best you can do right now. And you, unfortunately, you can't worry about everyone else who's not being treated fairly. It's just
and
unfair.
It really is. It's this, you know, very, it's just a pipe dream at this point for me, you know.
Yeah.
It's just where my business. Right. I mean, I wish most CEOs shared my philosophy. I just need what I need. I don't necessarily need to live like a dragon and just hoarding,
right.
you know, wealth. But we just don't, I mean, it's just not the reality.
Yeah, well, when you guys get there, I have a very high confidence and faith knowing you that you guys will compensate the rest of the employees and everyone else that got you there. And
oh my God.
That usually,
I tell my staff this every day. I'm like, this is not me. This is everybody. You know, we're not this good because of me. It's an us thing.
It's completely true.
And I hope, you know, I mean, again, it feels like people are critically thinking about this American capitalism philosophy, you know, very critically analyzing it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not this blind rush to worship people like Bezos, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the 1% of the 1%.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it is interesting because you're right. You're like, does it make sense for that small people to have that concentrated of the wealth, not right. just of the country, but of the world? And is there a more efficient way to do it where people are still rewarded for, because you still want to reward people for working hard and getting to the top, right?
Right.
So it's a balancing act, which is very tricky, and that's why I think things will shift and play out over time. But it's a very slow moving thing. It takes, you're going to take 10 or 20 years. But that's kind of would be my take on that. And that's a good question. I'm going to shoot you over to question number 3 now, if you have that ready for me.
Actually, this is a pretty good segue because the ease in entering stock trading,
mm-hmm.
right? And accessing investing for the, you know, investing personally for the future.
Yeah.
It seems more accessible, especially with all these apps like Robinhood. Like, people are literally doing penny bets.
Yeah.
It feels like.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think this is going to affect the long-term generations? And this, because there is this supposed barrier, right?
Yeah.
It's only the wealthy who do stock trading. And now with $50, I can jump on Robinhood and piss it away.
Yeah, no, you're right. You absolutely can. And that's a great question. And I'm going to answer that in a few parts.
Okay, I'm in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry for those listening. Andrew had some issue with his video, and now I can see him. So the conversation's going to just.
Got a new webcam for this? Hey,
you looking good. Looking good. That's a good question. I'm going to actually address this in two parts because you're absolutely right. People have unprecedented access to investing, to Acorns, to Robinhood, to doing things before that they couldn't. And I'm going to rewind back and give people a quick history of how it worked and why my job used to be just something that doesn't exist anymore. You know, back when our parents were growing up I'll just go back to like the 60s and 70s and 80s, before the internet and before things were global as much as they are now. If you wanted to invest in Apple or Amazon or a company in Europe or something, you had to find someone like me, a person registered, and they would, you'd call them, you would say, I want to buy, you know, 100 shares of this. I would purchase that for you. I might send you an actual physical certificate in the mail, or we might keep it with you in our database at our firm. And that was the only way you can do it, to be honest. And because of that, my job was, I have to know about these companies, and I have to be able to sell you on them, and I have to be able to talk to you all the time about buying and selling and investing. But now that's not the case. You don't need me to buy Apple. You go on any number of websites and you could buy Apple and know that it's probably a decent investment based on knowing the company. So my job and my experience and what I do for people has to change. And because of that, people and how they look at investments is going to change. So they don't necessarily need me to buy them Apple or Amazon because they can do it on their own, but they do need me to give them bigger picture advice about, well, how much should I get? and am I saving too much, and am I saving too little, and I have these stocks, is that diversified enough? Should I be putting it somewhere else? So you need bigger picture advice. So how I've tailored my business and how I work with people now is trying to change like that. So I do like a subscription model where I try to work with younger people and they pay me $50 a month, $100 a month. Yeah. And then they get me for the advice stuff. So they don't have to invest with me. They can invest however they want, do-it-yourselfers, all that stuff. But they might need to know, am I saving enough for retirement? Or am I putting enough in my 401k versus my bank? Or Ross, all of a sudden I have $50,000 in my bank. Is that too much money? Or hey, Ross, I just had a kid. Do I need to get life insurance? Do I need to get, you know, these things? Or Ross, I got a new job and my new company is offering these benefits. So all these bigger picture things, that's what people have always need help with. And that's what they'll continue to need help with as life becomes more evolving, because it's really good. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you give the audience some advice, baseline advice? So I just looked at the US median income.
Uh-huh.
And that is at 60 something thousand, 64,000 as of 2018.
Okay.
For somebody making that amount.
Uh-huh.
What would be the ideal amount to be investing in?
So that's a great question, and I'm going to use a percentage because I can't use dollars, because if you're making $64,000 in a rural place in a state that has lower expenses, then that's you're doing actually great and you could save a lot. If you're making $64,000 and living in Manhattan, you're screwed, right? You're not saving any of that. So I'm going to use a percentage. And I like to draw a little pie chart, okay? So the first pie is, well, what's going to go toward rent and mortgage? Buying or renting, either one. You want no more than 28% to go to that. Then 28% to go toward just a rent or mortgage and stuff like that. Let's say we throw in just debts. You have student loan debts. You have a car payment debt. You have other debts you have to pay in life for whatever they are. Then you bump that up to 36% of your debts. Okay. So of your income. So you wouldn't want to spend more than that on really debt. Okay. And the reason why is, well, then you have food, you have necessities, you have utilities that end up encompassing, let's say you've eaten up 30% of that already, they end up eating up about 40 to 50% of the others, which is, by that I just meant 40 to 50% of money that you're spending, you can't save that, right? Based on food, eating out, friends, clothes, emergencies, just stuff that happens in life. You can't save that. But that should leave almost everyone with about 25% left over, right?
To go into savings.
Right. So if you've looked at your own expenses and you don't have that 25% left over, you're spending too much on rent, on your debt, on food, on some other expenses. And you have to go through that budget and find somewhere where you could cut it out. Like maybe you're spending $5 a day in Starbucks and coffee, and that's why you can't save money, right? And that's a topic for another time. So that 25% should go towards something that's growing or protecting you. Some of that has to go towards health insurance. You have to have health insurance, auto insurance, homeowners insurance, rentals insurance. Sometimes it's disability, sometimes it's life, depending on your situation. About 10% goes to that. Once again, depending on your age and all that stuff. So most of the time you're left with 15 or 20% left, and that money should be saved. And it's very important to save at least 10 of that, but 20% to be more aggressive. The question is, well, where is that going? I want to put some of my 401k because maybe my company matches it and I get a tax benefit. Some of it has to go to the bank because I need money in the bank. It has to be in my checking or savings account. I have to have some money in there. And then if there's any leftover money, it can go towards a personal investment account or something that has a goal that's close to you. And that's why it's very important that you don't necessarily have to get everything down to a science, But you need to generally know what you're spending a month that's fixed, that you can't do anything without, that you have to spend the mortgage and the car payment and this and that, and that all have to get spent. And then what you have left over, what's that percentage? So it's usually a percentage of what you're doing. And it's a good thing to look at every year as life gets more expensive, as life changes, as you get a raise, as whatever happens. So hopefully that answered that question for the most part.
That's a segue I wanted to.
Yeah.
This is not information you and I learned growing up.
No, you don't learn this in school, unfortunately. That's the point of this podcast. Yeah.
I mean, my dad was very frugal with his money.
Mm-hmm.
But he never once sat me down and gave
no,
me
talk. No, no.
Learning. Now, if you had to introduce a curriculum, what would be the most essential thing that every student would need to know leaving?
Is that question four? Or is that question
three?
That's four. Okay. So and that's a really good question. So I didn't learn this too. Most of the people in my industry didn't learn this. And one of the reasons why I'm doing this podcast is I want people to learn it. And I want you to learn it at as young age as possible. Because making these real life mistakes actually has real life consequences. Because if you don't realize that you need to be saving for retirement until you're 45 years old, it could be too late, it could be too hard, and it changes your life. So I want people to have the knowledge when they're in their teens and 20s. Whether or not they do it isn't necessarily the point, but I want them to know about it as well. Sorry, could you repeat that question again?
So if you had to create a curriculum.
Oh, curriculum, okay.
What would be the most important point that every 18-year-old needs to know?
It's creating a budget and creating a saving strategy, and that's part of what my monthly fee works for people is on that, is you need to know, it doesn't have to be, let's comb through your credit card statement and find every statement, every expense. You don't have to be that exact, but you need to know, do you have any debts, student loans, car payments, what those debts are, how much are you paying in mortgage, how much are you making, where those percentages fit in. Then is also, are you married, are you single, do you have kids, do you have to have money go towards them? Do you have parents you're supporting based on your age and health, All of that stuff. Do you have health issues and stuff that you need to spend? Are you a fitness nut and you have all these hobbies, right? So where do your hobbies fit in? Because the important part of this is I don't want you to save 20% if it means you can't do the things you want to do now. That's also not part of this. So you have to carve out those percentages of the things that, Ross, I got to go to the gym. I got my personal trainer. It's expensive. It's $200 or $300 a month, whatever it is. But that's part of my life, and I don't want to sacrifice that. So these are all conversations, and you need to have priorities set. So you have to budget, and you have to have your goals and what's important to you, and you have to fit that in. And then from there, then you should figure out what's left over after all of that, if there's any wiggle room, and make sure you have a plan of where that excess money is going. Whether it's $25 a month or whether it's $1,000 a month, you have to have a plan. Putting it all in the bank is a bad plan. I'm telling you, it's a bad plan. Putting it all in investments is also a bad plan too. I'm telling you that it has to be, and that's part of my job is to invest your money, but in the right buckets, in the right places for the now, for the later, for the middle, for the different time horizons, for different stuff. So you have to have that set up and figured out. And that would be my curriculum, is to teach people how to do that. You don't have to know everything, but everyone's situation is different. So you can't just go on the internet and say, what should I be saving? It doesn't work because the internet doesn't know what's important to you. Only you do. So you need to do that. And if you're married or have a significant other, while you don't have to have the same goals, you should still communicate about what those are so you're on the same page. So it's very important to not avoid it. I know that's easy. And if you do want to avoid it, that's a better reason to just pay me the money and I can do that for you very quickly as well. But don't avoid it because it's going to have huge detriments to your future when you realize, oh crap, I should have done that 20 years ago and now I got to catch up. And that's unfortunate because then you have to sacrifice stuff. And I don't want you to have to sacrifice anything of your life to get what you want. And when you're young, in your 20s and 30s, you usually don't have to sacrifice too much to save what you need. But I do work with people who are 50s and 60s, and it's very difficult, almost impossible, to get their goals set at that age. Yeah. if you're behind. So I would say start early, educate yourself, get the knowledge set, and make sure you have a good plan. And just, you know, once again, you don't have to do this every day, but once a year is good to just refresh and look at it. Make it a New Year's goal, okay? Now is the perfect time. Hit the New Year's, find your budget or savings goal, and let's get it started.
That's, what about for people who don't even have that wiggle room to save? I
mean, right.
Paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
$30,000 a year.
So let's say your paycheck to paycheck, right? Because there's only three things you can do, right? If you said, I want to retire at this age with this amount of money, there's three ways we can do that, right? We could grow your money over time and take risk in the market. You could save more toward that goal. But if you can't save more toward that goal, the money has to come from somewhere. So your options are get another job and find a way to earn more money, or find what you're currently spending and cut something out. Those are tough decisions, and I can't make that for people. But I tell you, if you're in your situation, a lot of people are, the only way you can do it is find a way to make extra money or find a way to reduce your expenses. There's no get-rich-quick scheme. There's no, you know, there's no magical solution. It's tough. It sucks. It's hard work, and it's not fun, but that's the reality of it. Move in with your parents, right? Find roommates. Find a way to save the $500 a month. But that's it. You got to do it. You got to make a sacrifice somewhere. It's either working longer, working for, you know, Uber, finding a job that's going to earn you money, bringing more money in, or spending less, or altering your goals. Those are the three things.
Yeah.
That's it. Those are the only things you can do. And most of the time when I work with people, they don't want to work longer and harder because people are working long and hard. It's not like they're not working hard. So finding another way for income is not realistic. Cutting expenses is one of the hardest things for people to do because it's adjusting their lifestyle. And it's very difficult to adjust your lifestyle. Now, I could always go in and find a few things to do. So changing a goals is one of the things. It might be living less lavishly. It might be retiring later. It might be putting off a vacation for an extra few years. Or it might be investing much more aggressively than you want, knowing that you need to get a higher rate of return on your investments.
Or you can throw away your kids.
Or you could go to the black market and sell a kidney, right? These are all things, but I mean, that's really how it works. For the reality of most people, well, it'd be awesome to go play the Powerball lottery and win $500 million. That's not a good plan.
I had a long talk with my staff about it. So the Illinois Powerball is up to
like, it's up to like $500 million or $1 billion.
So they're all buying it. I'm like, dude, don't. Like, you're dropping, what, $10 per ticket?
If you did it once a year and bought a $10 ticket, I say go for it. That's
once
fun.
A year.
Right? But if you're doing it every week, that's probably an expense where I should say maybe that money could go somewhere else. So almost everyone, especially younger, has a way that they could reduce their expenses. I just tell you that.
Of course.
If we go through, and I work with younger people, and we go through a lot of stuff, and we put money away, and they find that if the money is going to a separate savings account instead of their bank account, then they just don't spend it. And sometimes money being there, they just spent. And some people have that issue. So I set up this account just so they can't get to it. And literally, I work with a few girls in their 20s, like Ross. If the money's in my account, I'm going to spend it on Uber. And this was before COVID. Uber and Lyft and going out and hanging out with my friends. So if you take the $200 a month and put it in the investments, I'm not going to miss it. I just won't go out as much. And that's fine. But I need you to do it for me because I can't do it myself.
Well, so I just started the a separate checking account with American Express because they have limited on how often I could withdraw.
Oh, interesting.
So it just forces me to just put it in there and walk away from it.
Yeah.
And it's got a pretty decent return too. So
yeah.
I'll do that. It's just pure cash.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going
to do. That's exactly what my philosophy would be for people. And I think a lot of times you just need sometimes like me, I'm not only a like not an investment manager, but I'm almost like a life coach who holds you accountable for your plan, because it's like that for people who try to get healthy or lose weight. It's the same thing. Well, you just need someone to help you.
It's a lifestyle.
Yeah, change. Yeah, really yeah. It's hard. It's hard to do it on your own, and most millions of people struggle with these things, with whatever it is, because either they feel alone or they just need a little bit of help. It's not a huge change, but yeah, that's how I would recommend doing it. But there's no magical solution. I mean, work harder, or get another job to make money, find a way to spend less, or change your goals. That's it, yeah. Right? Barring winning the lottery or having some rich uncle in France die and you inherit money, this is what you're looking at. So be realistic, and it's hard work. I tell people this is hard. This is not easy to do this.
Yeah.
It's disciplined. Yeah. It takes a long time. And so don't expect immediate results. So that's my answer to that.
That was a solid. To all the audience listening, you guys, listen to this guy.
Thanks. Thanks for the plug.
This dude is legit.
I appreciate that.
Korean barbecue after.
I would love. I would love to
let you pick the last one, because I have two questions.
Okay.
First is, have you heard about Reddit Wall Street Bets?
No. So let's do a different one.
Oh, then we'll move past. Okay.
Yeah.
You should look into it.
Okay, I will.
It's just a bunch of crazy people.
Okay.
The last one is okay. As I'm growing up too, I'm noticing that the difficulties in entering as like a small business owner, it's becoming more and more restrictive just because of the cost. Now, how is that affecting you, and what do you think? It just feels like just another, house built on sand. It's so restricting. So I only got this because I was listening to a podcast, and they were talking about the company Little Debbie's little pastry cakes,
Oh, okay.
Hostess's biggest rival. Dude, it was a family from like 1920. They sold their car, bought a bakery.
Right.
That's how they started. You can't sell a car to buy a bakery today.
No.
The investing partners for my shop, it was $200,000.
Yeah.
That was simply to renovate an already built out restaurant. Nobody has $200,000.
No.
So where do you see this going as a long term? This is just another bubble. It's just more restrictive barriers to the lower class.
Yes,
upward mobility.
I think it is. It's a travesty, to be honest. It's really sad because a lot changed after 2008 with the financial crisis and the banks being very tight of who they lend money to. And unfortunately, that hurts exactly what you're saying, the mom, pa, the small businesses that need those loans from banks to start out. So until banks change that, which may or may not happen, I get it. They need to be diligent and they can't just hand out money to everyone, but they should loosen their purse strings a little bit on that.
Right.
Now, what we've seen more and more is there's a lot of venture capitalists, rich, wealthy people who are looking to invest in these things. The problem is a lot of them are concentrated in certain areas. A lot of them are concentrated in certain industries. So what I think would be a great thing to do, and I don't have control over this, but what I'm hoping what we get to in the future is that local governments have to partner with people. Yes, the governments, the municipalities, the city of wherever you are, needs to work with the small businesses for tax breaks, economical, offer stuff, work with the banks, the local banks as well, where everything has to be in unison to get in the right businesses. Because while it's great to have all these tech companies around, people also need restaurants to go to. People need things to do for the economy.
Right.
And so all these small little towns, and I learned this because I was on the Chamber of Commerce in Wilmette. In Evanston. I was in the Rotary Club of Wilmette and Chamber of Commerce in Evanston, and I went to a meeting and the mayor was there and he was speaking about how while we want to bring in all the financial planners and the lawyers and the law firms and the doctor offices, we're picky of who we bring in because we want our downtown area to be filled with places that people are going to go. So we want retail shops. We want restaurants, right? We want to bring the people in and go because we know that's better for the community. So they were picking and choosing who they let in. So along those lines, it is good, and it's why downtown Wilmette got so revitalized and why other downtown areas in the North Shore weren't doing as well, because once again, doctor offices are great, but it doesn't revitalize a community. You need places that people could feel, and food and stores and places you go to buy things is a little bit, it's a little bit better. Now, you have to take that further. The next step is you have to encourage the Andrew O's, the small business guys who have an idea, to find a way for them to partner with people with money, with banks, to make it all work symbiotically, so you could bring those in. Because right now, if you wanted to start a business and you might have a great business idea and something, they're not going to give you, it's so difficult to start. And that creates a huge barrier of entry, which allows the big guys to continue and the small guys to get squashed like cockroaches, which is good for some, but I think there's a way for everyone to win. I don't necessarily think it's great for small towns and small communities. I think they need small businesses, and I think they need access to capital, but the local governments have to do that. It has to be a mission. They have to do it, and they have to be proactive about it. Otherwise, you can't just say, Andrew, go do it on your own. You need their help. You need the city of Evanston to help you and support you and find a way for it to happen. Yeah.
The asymmetrical effect of the quarantine on businesses. I mean, I'm sure you know this, but the amount of small businesses that have just been shuttered and demolished in the last 10 months. I mean, you know, just in downtown Evanston right now, besides like the big names like Jimmy John's, Chipotle, they're doing fine because they're a national brand.
Mm-hmm.
But small businesses, if you come through today, man, it's gone.
The restaurants.
Like, almost every.
It's sad.
I know, but not just the food industry, but, you know, small retail shops.
Yes,
You can't survive it.
And I think that's bad.
People are just jumping on Amazon.
Right, and it's bad for it might be okay for a customer if they want to buy something cheap and convenient. I get it. But overall, for the community, I think it's bad. I think there's going to be some negative long-term side effects if we don't find a way to revitalize small business. And like I said, the town has to help. The municipalities have to help. And a lot of it has to do with rent, too. Because unlike like my business, I don't have to have a put down rent to rent a spot. I could do everything remotely. But you're a business and retail, there's a lot of businesses that have to have an actual space to do it, and rents are out of control. And
the inflation on
property, that's part of an issue. So what you need to do is you need to help people, you need to subsidize it, and you have to do some type of tax breaks at multiple levels to incentivize people to do it. Once again, I'm not going to be able to get you the specifics. I don't think, you know, I think it requires a whole team effort. I think it really requires a lot of people working together to do it. But there's answers to this. And I think the way youth and younger people are going, I think people are starting to realize this. And I'm hoping there's more push in the future for politics to get more involved with helping small businesses out and doing it. Because it is good for the community. You know, Evanston is good when there's all these locally owned, local areas, shops there that, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Mr. and Mrs. Whoever Doe are working there. And it's nice. And as long as it's not price gouging, as long as they're charging you a fair price and you're getting a quality product for it, I think it's good. And right now, I would not recommend anyone to open up a restaurant or a retail shop right now. It's a bad investment, and it's just too hard. It's just too hard, right?
But you know, you and I talked about this last week. I mean, fortunately though, for me and my partners, it's, you know, we are gonna have the pick of the crop to have all these empty storefronts.
Yeah, that's true.
Again, at the end of the day, though, you know, it comes off the skeletons of what was once Giants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really unfortunate. To end this on a really light note, I think you're right. I think our generation and the incoming generations are very conscious of the class disparity and the wealth disparity. And I'm hoping for great things. I'm hoping, you know, we return to the roaring 20s? No, wait, no, that ended in the Great Depression. So we don't want to do that.
The 20s were good until 1929 until the stock market crashed. Yeah.
Until the banks just
I think there needs to be a balance between that and also there still has to be the right regulation, right? Because all this stuff still has to be regulated. We can't just have crazy markets and then people doing all this stuff and, you know, hiding assets and stuff. So I think we've gotten away from the balance of capitalism and socialism. And by socialism, I mean just like, well, we should...
Just regulated.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, there needs to be a little bit better balance. And right now it feels like it's more of a runaway for the top 1% of the 1% to make all the money. And not trickle down enough to everyone else, and small businesses continually getting crushed or bought out.
Right.
By a lot of times, people say, "I want to start a business so I could sell it to Amazon or I could sell it to the top guys." Right. And I'm like, "Well, that's also not great too. I mean, we need competition. We need there to be more than just one internet and phone company. We need there are, and now there feels like there's like three different airlines and that's it. We need more of that. We need more variety, more competition, because it helps breed innovation, and that's good. And small businesses help push the larger guys. And if there's not enough of that, the larger guys are just going to sit and be like, here's our money. Right. And that's, I think a lot of times businesses in those cycles end up working itself out, because I think overall they are efficient. But we do need to make sure we're not going too extreme. Yeah.
If we could ever introduce new antitrust laws that would prevent these giant conglomerates from merging. To the young listeners, there used to be 40 different airlines in the U.S.
You
would not believe it.
I know. All these, you know, Delta's owned by someone, right? There's no more Northwest. I mean, all of these are, I know there's United and American, and then there's like JetBlue and Southwest, and those are really the four I could think of besides a few low-budget ones. But there's really, I mean, it's like that. Same with hotels. There's lots of different hotels, but they all seem to be owned by Hilton or the Marriott, right?
And there used to be different phone providers. Uh-huh. There used to be local municipal utilities that competed with them, and it's all gone.
I would encourage that, and I'll leave it on this, is that a lot of the solutions to this is that people like you and young people need to get more involved in politics and more involved in the local side of things and figure out who's running, what their stances are, how it works for the economics, and if they're not happy, run themselves, especially on a local level. If you think you want to revitalize an area and you want to start a business, unfortunately, becoming involved in politics might be the best way to do that. And I encourage people to do that on a small level, because that's really how you see this change and know all this. Because all these, I think like a lot of this stuff gets glossed over bigger and, let's be honest, more important issues right now. But it doesn't mean these other things aren't important too. And I think they get a little overlooked when everything's as crazy as they are now. But people get involved. If you're passionate and you want to do this stuff, look up what your local what your local government's doing, where you live. And if you're not happy with that, try to find a way to change it, because that's a lot easier than changing it at a national level. That's very hard. Changing it if you live in a small town and you want to start a business, talk to the people on city council and find a way to make it happen.
Chamber of Commerce. And I recommend that.
Those are important things.
Find your local community center, be a part of their associate boards or Chamber of Commerce. Just get your voice heard.
Yeah.
And I think that is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Who's your local rep? You're in Chicago. Who's your alderman? Because I bet you that person.
Yeah. I don't know. See, I'm not involved in that stuff on my end, and I should be, because that's really, it all does play in, it all does connect. It all connects politics and government and small business and the banks, and it all connects. And it would be nice if it worked a little bit better together so things could work smoothly. I'm going to leave it at that. Thanks. Those were some great thought-provoking. I'm glad you had some good questions. I think this was an interesting conversation. Andrew, I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Thanks for joining me. Thanks for joining the Money Seat. Thanks, listeners. I hope you found this useful and maybe brought some people to take action. If anything, you heard this and you're like, I'm going to I'm gonna try to make some changes in my life and get involved and make a budget, then we accomplished our goal. So once again, thanks for joining me on the Money Seat. Thanks again for my host, Andrew. And I'll talk to you next time.
Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professionals prior to making a decision. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful.